Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. Jeff Fawcett and I come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health and the environment.
Are we suffering from too much civilization? For example, I'm sure you're aware of the claim that we are on the verge of, or even in the midst of, a mass extinction of plants and animals brought on by human activity. For decades, scientists and environmental organizations have been talking about both species extinction and loss of biodiversity as serious threats. Lots of national and international effort by both government and civil society has been focused on stopping the onslaught with the very best civilization has to offer. Science, technology, experts, and governments, including the use of police power to enforce conservation policies. Yet the process now seems unstoppable. Some scientists and activists argue that conservation of species, which means conservation of the ecosystem on which they depend, is accomplished best by the people indigenous to the ecosystem, people who do not manage endangered species but live among and depend on them. Deep Green Resistance is an organization that takes the position that civilization and its benefits are not only of no help in solving the problems of species extinction, climate crisis, and ecosystem collapse, but is the active cause of those threats. Today, you'll hear about their strategy for saving life on Earth. My guests are Will Falk and Max Wilbert, both members of the Deep Green Resistance Steering Committee. Will is an award-winning writer, lawyer, and activist. His work has been published by Earth Island Journal, the Dark Mountain Project, Counterpunch, and the San Diego Free Press, among others. Max Wilbert cut his teeth organizing against racism, police brutality, and war in Seattle. He now lives in rural Oregon and focuses on providing training and skills to activists, as well as forest and water protection campaigns in the Great Basin. He's currently working on his first book, which looks at the costs and problems of green technology. Will and Max, welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness.
It's great good to be here.
Thanks. Deep Green Resistance argues that civilization itself is the problem. A lot of what your analysis consists of focuses on that idea. My understanding of what you mean by civilization has to do with at the level of organization that human beings are currently at, they are beyond the carrying capacity of ecosystems where they live. So, could you comment on that and what exactly it is that you mean by civilization and why it's problematic?
Yeah, we're really careful about how we define civilization. When you look at the word civilization, you'll realize that the root of the word is civil. And civil derives from civis, which comes from the Latin civitatis, which means city-state. So from there, we can define civilization as a culture that is a complex of stories, institutions, and artifacts that both leads to and emerges from the growth of cities. And we define cities so as to distinguish them from camps, villages, and the like, as people living more or less permanently in one place in densities high enough to require the routine importation of food and other necessities of life. This becomes problematic because when people live in populations that exceed the carrying capacity of their land base, they end up stripping their land of the necessities of life, and they have to look to other lands to get what they need. And it's no coincidence that many scholars date the beginning of civilization with the birth of agriculture, and that's usually between 10 and 12,000 years ago. And despite the fact that agriculture has favorable connotations in most circles, even in most environmental circles, I think, the great author Lear Keith has described what is exactly the problem with agriculture. And she says, in very brute terms, you take a piece of land, you clear every living thing off of it, and then you plant it to human use. And instead of sharing that land with the other million creatures who need to live there, you're only growing humans on it. And Lear calls that biotic cleansing. So with its roots in agriculture and with its roots in biotic cleansing and with its roots in humans exceeding carrying capacity, civilization has quite simply been destroying the planet from its very beginning.
So let me ask a question about agriculture and what that encompasses. For instance, in contrast to agriculturally based civilization groups, one thinks of hunter-gatherers as peoples who basically live by harvesting as opposed to producing food off of land, and that they live within that land's limits. But there have been a number of active groups and scientists looking at something called agroecology, which is an attempt to produce food intentionally on plots of land, but to do so within the limits of the ecology where that happens. So does agriculture include practices like, permaculture and agroecology?
I think one of the keys there is what you said about permaculture. And I don't know if I would define agriculture along the same lines as permaculture. So you mentioned hunter-gatherers, and I think that hunter-gatherers have truly been and have truly created the only sustainable cultures that the planet has seen. And usually when you say something like that, people get kind of upset, or they think, what can you mean? Like, we could all go back and live as hunter-gatherers. But the truth is, humans have been around between 300 and 400,000 years. We haven't evolved all that much from what we were 300,000 and 400,000 years ago. And from 400,000 years ago until about 10,000 years ago, all humans lived as hunter-gatherers. And whatever their problems might have been, the wholesale destruction of the planet was not one of their problems. And it just simply wasn't thinkable that we could push this planet and that we could take down all the rest of life on Earth with us. So we have a long tradition of living as hunter-gatherers, and in fact, agriculture is kind of this new fad with humanity. And we can live that way, and in fact, there are about 46 hunter-gatherer cultures that still exist around the world. And if we're ever going to get back to truly sustainable cultures, I think they'll have to resemble the hunter-gatherer lifestyles that truly are our heritage.
The implication of what you're describing is that the solutions to the serious problems we face from the standpoint of deep green resistance seem to be that we need to live within the carrying capacity of the ecosystems within which where we are. One of the questions I have about that is how difficult it is to define an appropriate population size and ecosystem boundary. There are lots of ways to define an ecosystem. It could be in terms of watershed, or it could be in terms of keystone species, a lot of ways to do it. So in terms of population size and just the idea of carrying capacity, how do we figure out what those boundaries are?
Well, I think that underlying your question, or this can lead to a really good point, and I think that the way we define that is going to be very different for every natural community that humans are seeking to live in. And I think that, you would live differently and with different a definition for human carrying capacity in Central or Northern California, where you are, compared to the high desert of Utah, where I am. So I think that it would necessarily be different for every one of those natural communities. And I think that there was an organization of human culture that existed on this continent until about 200 or 300 years ago, where traditional and indigenous peoples had more or less figured out what the definition of human carrying capacity was for their ecosystems. And I think that one of the really brilliant indigenous writers, Vine Deloria, in the late 20th century, he talked a lot about how the only really sustainable government that we can implement around the world are these local autonomous cultures that resemble much like the traditional cultures that existed on North America before the arrival of Europeans. So I guess that was a long way to answer your question as I think that's going to depend on the each individual local land base, and it's going to rely on the people living there to really figure that out.
As a consequence of that, this analysis that Deep Green Resistance has, you have a two-part analysis. One is that industrial civilization is collapsing. We are not only seeing biotic collapse, but we're also witnessing social collapse. And it is that social system that is the cause of the biotic collapses. The second part of the analysis, which in many ways distinguishes your work from other organizations, even organizations that are as militant as yours is that what will survive is self-sustaining modes of living. I would like you to talk about first what the analysis is of the pending collapse of industrial civilization, and then what it means to be survived by self-sustaining modes of living or communities, settlements, the analysis.
I think, you know,
this, and before you go, this is Max Wilbert who's speaking.
Yeah, I'm so happy to be on. Thanks for having us and for these great questions. So I think, yeah, the collapse is ongoing, and I think, you know, you mentioned biotic collapse, and I really think that's the key point. You know, we are seeing this sort of collapse or degradation of industrial society, but, you know, unfortunately, this society doesn't seem like it's on the brink. And I say unfortunately because it's this culture that's causing the destruction of the planet. And, you know, just last week I heard that the U.S. overtook Saudi Arabia as the world's largest oil producer. And, you know, unfortunately, this culture is doing whatever it can to sustain itself, including, you know, drilling for oil in the Arctic and going to the deep water and tar sands and all these sorts of schemes that any empire tries to come up with to sustain its, you know, its despotic rule as these natural limits come to the fore. So, but, you know, whether you look at whatever sort of indicators you look at in terms of the natural world, we're seeing mass destruction. I mean, scientists are estimating now that 70% of coral reefs are going to be gone in the next few decades. There are 150 dead zones in the ocean. Corporations dump something like 5 million gallons per day of toxins across the planet. You know, the populations of all kinds of species are collapsing down to the phytoplankton in the oceans, who are responsible for the majority of the oxygen that we breathe on this planet. And their populations have fallen by 40% or more. So, you know, we could go on and on about the different things: deforestation, the loss of old growth forests, the loss of soils and desertification due to industrial agriculture, the toxification of the environment through those various chemicals that are being released. So I think it's pretty obvious what this culture is doing to the planet. And, you know, it's not a new thing. People have this tendency to look at what's happening today and think that it's a result of modern capitalism or modern industrialism. But I sort of look at those factors as just gasoline poured on the fire. They're accelerants. They're not really the root cause of the problem in some ways. I was just reading a study the other day that was looking at an archaeological site in Israel, one of the longest continuously inhabited places on the planet, this small port city that's been inhabited for 6,000 or 7,000 years. I don't think I'm getting that number correct, but a long time. And what they found was that, you know, as soon as the city was created and as soon as it turned from a village into a city, and that gets back to that definition that Will mentioned at the beginning in terms of routine importation of resources. As soon as they got to that point where they weren't really living off the land and in relationship with the land, but they were sort of living in this commodity economy where things were delivered to them from elsewhere, it's sort of an out of sight, out of mind thing. And, you know, it seems pretty clear from not only what's happening on the planet, but also social science research and so on, that humans are best suited to live in these small, localized communities. You know, people talk about how we're made to live with a community of up to 100 or 150 people maximum. And when our societies start to get bigger than that in terms of people we interact with or are around on a day-to-day basis, we just kind of start to fall apart. So I think that really reflects the inherent localism that defines us as a species. And, you know, we've strayed from that over the past several thousand years. And as a result, we're living through the sixth great mass extinction event.
I want to pause here I'm sorry for interrupting, but I need to ID the show. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. I'm talking today with, or I've just been talking with Max Wilbert, and I'm also talking to Will Falk earlier about deep brain resistance. This is a very telling idea of when things fall apart because we are living in communities that are really larger than we can handle. And in a way, that points to the collapse of civilization in addition to the bad effects that it has. But I want to hear you talk about, because this is, like I said, one of the unique things about that I've found about deep green resistance, is this second part of the analysis, not just that human beings, human societies are causing devastating environmental effects, that part of the strategy is to seek to find self-sustaining modes of living. So I would like for you to talk about that part of your analysis.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I can speak to that too. So, you know, Will mentioned that these things kind of have to look different in different places. And I think people often, you know, we talk about this in DGR, this idea of self-sustaining communities and localism and so on. But it's not really the core of the work that we do. And the reason for that is because there are a lot of people already doing so much great work in that area. And so because of that, you know, because there are so many people working on those sorts of things in the permaculture movement, in the rewilding movement, you know, in this sort of broad back to the land movement that we're sort of seeing a new iteration of, restoration and so on. We're not really taking a primary role there because we're seeing a big gap in terms of the resistance part. And that's why our group is called Deep Green Resistance, is because we're focused on that. So we have these ideas around restoration and self-sustaining communities, you know, and at the same time, it's not really my primary work for myself. I mean, it's something that I do personally. You know, I like to go out and harvest mushrooms and collect acorns from the oak trees where I live and learn, you know, learn how to live in balance with the place where I am and begin to develop that sort of relationship and build a community of people who are doing the same thing and spread those ideas. But at the same time, I don't think the reason that the world is being killed is a lack of, you know, sustainable eco-villages or communes. I think the real reason the world is being killed is more direct. It's looking at, you know, the industry, the military activity. You know, the military is the largest polluter on the planet. So I think in terms of that type of work, it's absolutely something that we like to highlight, because I think those two wings of the movement have to go hand in hand. You know, we need people doing the healing work, the restoration work, the creating sustainable communities and sane communities and helping people to recover from, you know, this culture destroys our internal selves just as it's destroying the external world all around us, you know, through propaganda and through patriarchy and racism and all these different toxic lessons, the addictions and so on that this culture feeds us. And I think we absolutely need to repair that and work on and address those issues critically. And I think that also needs to be paired inextricably with a resistance movement that's working sort of on the front lines to stop the harms that are still devastating everything and making things worse.
One of the things that I think also is unique about your organization is that it does not see itself as, at least as I understand what your objectives are and how you see the work that you do, is that you're not an environmental organization. That is, you're not focused singly on ecological issues, but also on social work, so that your organization has serious discussions about how doing this this Save the Planet work as being integral to and inseparable from social justice issues, such as you just mentioned. So, I'd like you to talk a little bit more about how those things get integrated.
Sure, I can speak to that briefly, and then Will might have something to add. But one of my friends is this really brilliant feminist, and she said something a couple years ago that just blew me away, just the concise way that she phrased it. And she said, all oppression is tied to resource extraction. And I think that's critical. It's basically a materialist analysis, right? I mean, this goes back a long ways in the radical movement. This goes back over 100+ years in terms of leftist politics. And an understanding that, you know, racism doesn't just exist because some white people decided, hey, let's hate black people. That's a great idea. You know, they created racism to justify slavery, to justify exploitation, to justify colonialism. And, you know, it's the same way with patriarchy. The culture has created these ideologies, these toxic lessons around pornography and objectification and media and so on, in order to justify the resource extraction from women. And, you know, that comes in the form of free labor or women working for a lower wage, right, or it comes in the form of, you know, women having to basically have children to feed the empire. You know, I mean, there's a reason that right-wing politicians in this country are against abortion and against women having control of their own reproductive systems and their own bodies. And it's because they want growth. And the way you get growth is in large part via population growth. They want more babies. They want more people. They want more consumers. They want more soldiers. They want more of everything. And, you know, women don't want to have that. So, you know, if you look at the numbers, when you give women control over their own bodies and autonomy, then they actually choose to have much less children.
That's right.
And so all of these things are inextricably connected. I think it's a total mistake. You know, I mean, you could talk about immigration, for example, as well, for a hot topic right now. You know, farmers who are living in rural Mexico don't just decide, hey, let's pick up my whole life and move to the United States. You know, the reason that most of these people are moving is because they're fleeing war, they're fleeing environmental destruction, they're fleeing violence, they're fleeing, you know, the corruption of their societies that have been, you know, and that's the legacy of colonization, of globalized trade, free trade agreements, of capitalism, and the sort of imperialist policies that the U.S. and other nations have been pushing for decades and hundreds of years. So I think to even look at these sort of issues as separate things is sort of a mistake. I think they're all part of the same struggle and they're all related. They all have their differences, of course,
And it's important to look individually at each struggle and each situation as a discrete case. But at the same time, it's all part of the system of how this culture extracts resources and you know, works to control and exploit the entire planet.
So, Will, we've got a little bit of time if you'd like to comment.
Yeah, I love everything Max said, and I love that quote about oppression is always linked to resource extraction. I think the only thing that I would add, or the only different angle that I take with it is in the same vein that resource extraction is how the powerful get their power. There's no coincidence that one of the oldest and most destructive environmental practices, mining, is tied to the construction of, you know, the first bronze swords, the first iron weapons, the first steel weapons. This kind of environmental extraction was used and proliferated because it created military power. And once people have military power, they can force other people to do what they want for them. It's also no coincidence that the first it wasn't until agriculture that we saw the first standing armies, because once you could feed enough people that there could that you could take away from people's need to be hunting and gathering, that you could now, you know, put a sword or a spear in their hand and say, hey, let's go take something from someone else. So just like Max said, they're all connected. Deep down, they're all connected. And I would say that environmental extraction goes hand in hand with social dominance. So environmentalism finds natural allies in the social justice movement, and we hope to continue encouraging the social justice movement to find allies in the environmental movement.
We're going to have to take a brief musical break right now. When we come back, we will continue talking to Max Wilbert and Will Falk about deep green resistance and what you can do. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. You're in the right place. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. I'm talking today with Will Falk and Max Wilbert from the Deep Green Resistance Organization about environmental activism and not only creating a different world, but saving the one we've got. Our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, has more information about this show and our archive of almost 700 shows, a free stream of today's show, and access to our archive of show recording, which is now free and open access. To contact us, email us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Max, how can listeners learn more about Deep Green Resistance?
Well, the easiest thing to point people towards is our website, which is deepgreenresistance.org. But I definitely recommend that people go beyond that. I feel like that's sort of the easy way out these days to get people involved in clicktivism and doing things online, you know, when the reality is that face-to-face is so much better and more important. So we have contact information on our website. Get in touch, let us know where you are, and ask if there's anybody in your area or your region who would be willing to get together with you and sit down and talk about these things in person, or come to any community groups you're involved in or any spaces you're involved in. Because I really think that, organizing is all about building real relationships, and that sort of thing doesn't happen online. It happens face-to-face. So I definitely recommend people do that.
Great. I'd like to hear from the two of you about the things that Deep Green Resistance is doing, in particular, how that differs from what mainstream environmental organizations are doing, and most importantly, how those projects serve your strategic goals.
I can go ahead and get started. Yeah. And Will, do you want to chip in?
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
Okay, great. So I can just run through real quick. I put together a list. So for people who are members of Deep Green Resistance, we have sort of a formal process for membership and people getting officially involved. And part of that is submitting a couple little reports a few times a year just about what have you been up to, what kind of work are you doing. So from that and from talking to people, it's possible to assemble a pretty good list of what everyone's up to. And we have some people who are fighting coal mines in Australia. We have people who are working on pipeline resistance work in New York, New England, the broader New England area, and Florida. We have some people working on old growth forest protection in British Columbia, as well as in Australia, fighting fracking in Colorado and in the UK. We have people working on behalf of both the buffalo here in the U.S. and the European buffalo. We have people doing prairie dog defense work along the Front Range in Colorado especially. We have a lot of people doing media and support work. Our website, I recently realized, is now partially or fully translated into 21 languages. And that's been done all by volunteers, grassroots volunteers, people who have just contacted us and said, we appreciate your strategy and we appreciate what you're doing, so we want to help spread this information by translating. We have people doing restoration projects and native gardening projects in various areas, indigenous solidarity work in a few different areas around the country and around the world. And then Will can talk a little bit more about maybe some of our Pinyon Juniper stuff and Rights for Nature work, Will?
Yeah, we just, a group of DGR members recently helped to file a First in the Nation lawsuit seeking the rights of nature for a major ecosystem, and that major ecosystem was the Colorado River. We did that. That flowed from our understanding of some of the major problems within the United States, at least, and that major problem being in one of the very foundations of American culture, and that is the American legal system. The American legal system currently treats nature as property, and because nature is treated as property, it is consumed and destroyed. So we were trying to get our hands in the actual machinery of American law and try to twist that into a court declaration that would actually recognize the rights of nature. We've long been involved in protecting pinyon juniper forests in the Intermountain West, so from the Colorado Plateau all the way over into eastern California. This work has sprung up kind of incidentally to work to stop the Southern Nevada Water Authority's water grab. The Southern Nevada Water Authority has plans to drain several Great Basin valleys of their groundwater to fuel or to get water to Las Vegas. And as we were going through the Great Basin, we started to notice that there were these big tracts of forest that were clear cut. They're actually chained, which is a process of stretching a Navy battleship's anchor chain between two tractors and driving it across the land and pulling up everything in its path. But we think that the rights of nature work can fold into the pinyon juniper work too, because the pinyon juniper biotic communities are essential to life in the Great Basin, and as long as they're not even recognized as beings with their own worth, they'll continue to be clear cut.
Could I just interject here? One of the things that is fascinating about that issue, and there's an organization that we've interviewed on this show that you're working with called the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund that is very much focused on that rights of nature issue. That seems to be one of the issues, the things that you are involved in that really directly goes to this issue of hastening the collapse of civilization. It is the most obvious piece of activity to give environments rights in social systems. So if you could talk some about how, maybe talk a little bit more about how you would envision that from an organizational standpoint as achieving this goal or moving towards this goal of hastening the collapse of civilization.
Yeah, I think the first thing that I want to say about the rights of nature, and this is something that I've really learned a lot from Thomas Lindsay, the executive director of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund that you just mentioned. And what I want to say is the rights of nature are not what most people think they are. And what I mean by that is while it would be great if the American legal system could somehow change itself to recognizing the natural world as being inherently valuable and granting the natural communities that give us rights the same rights as other citizens, the same rights as corporations even have. But I would like to suggest that the rights of nature movement is not so much about that as it is about showing people firsthand, walking them through the process of trying to create change through the American legal system, having them invest their hopes and dreams and their energy in making this change, only to have the courts and the government that's supposed to represent them break those dreams, dash those dreams, show them that they don't actually live in a democracy. And what happens when those people's dreams and hopes are dashed like that is they're radicalized on the spot. They are they all of a sudden have this anger that if it can be directed in the right ways, we can actually use to make the changes that we aren't being able to make through the legal system. So the way that fits into DGR's, one of our goals to hasten the collapse of industrial civilization is, you know, you can't just walk into a room of people and say, hey, we really need to hasten the collapse of industrial civilization. most people don't, they're not there yet in their understanding. They also, you know, they're not ready for that, and they still hold on to this belief that we can vote the right people into office and make the changes, or we can through really smart arguments by lawyers. And I'm a lawyer, so I'm saying this self-deprecatingly, that if we can just make really smart arguments that the change is going to be made. So the rights of nature and breaking people's dependence and hope in these ineffective tactics, this is a really persuasive way to that goes beyond rational argument. I think this is a very persuasive way to get into people's hearts and to catalyze that anger that they're going to need to begin taking actions to hasten the collapse of industrial civilization. I think that one of the main roles that DGR fills is we're one of the few organizations that are actually creating the messaging, that are actually out there saying, hey, industrial civilization is bad, it needs to come down. And that is fine as far as it goes. We can say that, and we can try and convince people that we're right. But we also need to really get into people's hearts, like I was saying. We need to show them, we need to give them that radical education that only experience can give them. So DGR is involved in some of these campaigns that like the Rights of Nature, that take people through the process, let them see firsthand how the system does not work in their favor, and then DGR is there with other ideas that are beyond perhaps the legal system for working against civilization.
So, Max, did you want to add anything?
Sure. Yeah, I would just add that, you know, we've talked about some of the work that DGR is doing, but one of the great things that's really laid out in the book that's hard to cover in just a few minutes on the call, because we write about it extensively in the book and in great detail. We dive into an actual strategy for dismantling industrial civilization, and it's a two-pronged strategy. It's split into what we call above ground and what we call underground. And above ground is what our organization is. We're basically doing legal work, and when I say legal, I mean stuff that isn't illegal. So we do take part in some nonviolent civil disobedience and some sort of relatively minor law breaking like that. But we actually call for underground organizations, which is really like a revolutionary organization. To go underground and actually target some of the key systems that support industrial civilization. So things like the finance system, global communications, global energy systems and fuel systems. And, you know, when I've talked to people who are military veterans who have training in these sort of things, they look at that strategy and they say, that's a good strategy. They say it's an effective strategy. And I don't, you know, I'm involved in DGR because I think there's something to this strategy, but I also want to say I don't think it's the end-all and be-all. I think it's one way of approaching things, and I think we have a lot of value to offer to people in terms of strategic thinking and in terms of pushing people to be more radical and more militant in our thinking and recognizing that we are actually living in a war. We're living through a period of wartime, war against the planet. And that we need to stop that war. And so, you know, I think that the fact that we're, as Will said, we're one of, if not the only organization that's both calling for an end to industrial civilization and actually providing a strategy that has a chance to get us there.
I need to pause here and ID the show. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. I'm talking today with Max Wilbert and Will Falk about the organization Deep Green Resistance. One of the things that's quite interesting about both the specific things that you sent me, but also in the book, is that it has, as you describe, it's an organization that has a rather comprehensive range of kinds of actions that can be taken, that you envision them being taken as part of this developing resistance movement, the movement that you envision. There's two phrases that are, it was in a piece that Will had sent me, and I don't remember if it appears anywhere else, but there were two phrases. One was that you promote what you're about is creating a life-centered resistance movement, and by any means necessary. In the book, there's an extensive discussion of the use of the word resistance, and in particular in association with resistance movements during World War II. I would like you to talk about the meaning of that word resistance, because I think it's actually quite important why resistance is in the name and its significance. But then I would also like you to talk about by any means necessary, which I associate and many other people associate that with
right.
Malcolm X, about why that phrase and its meaning for your organization. So first, resistance movement. What is the significance of that for your organization, for Deep Green Resistance?
Yeah, resistance connotes, I think it connotes that strategic thinking, that militancy. Resistance is more than just lifestyle changes. It's more than just, you know, changing your light bulbs and riding your bike to work. Resistance, I think that we use that word specifically to connote this strategic and militant and highly organized groups of people that are resisting, that are fighting against civilization and the forces in power. And yeah, the way that this ties to World War II resistance groups, I think that's a great connection that the word brings in. And when you think of those groups, especially groups in Eastern Europe who they were sitting, they had just seen their national governments overrun by the Nazis, as one example, or they had just seen their national governments overrun by a military force that just was completely overpowered them, and they had so many fewer resources than the armies that were occupying them, and yet they were very, very effective in resisting the Axis powers, and they were very, very effective in using the few resources that they had. And I think that's what it's going to take for us. We don't have that many resources, and we never are going to have as many resources as those in power, but we have to get very, very smart and very effective about how we mount this resistance against civilization.
Well, one of the things that's quite interesting, a discussion in the book around this issue, is that they frankly acknowledge that there just is not the social movement available now to turn it around. But strategically placed, it can be that's really one of the interesting things about the organization, is it sees that the civilization is collapsing under its own weight, and that can be sped up with the hope of creating conditions that will save the natural world. You have no illusions about you bringing civilization to its knees on your own, but that you are part of a movement that will speed that process, that already existing process, up.
Just to add one real quick thing, I think resistance also has the connotation of an asymmetric struggle, basically meaning that, you know, we're the resistance movement that we're a part of, the amount of resources and the number of people we have, the forces that we have at our disposal are basically a pittance compared to what we're facing. And so, you know, resistance has this connotation of struggling against a vastly superior force, which obviously involves a lot of trade-offs and a lot of basically getting sneaky and trying to get really smart so that you can be effective.
By any means necessary.
Yeah, so obviously, as you said, Malcolm X was the one who popularized that phrase. And I was just doing some reading yesterday, and a couple quotes popped out at me to throw down in the interview today. And the first one is by a guy named Robert Williams in a book called Negroes with Guns, which is a look at armed resistance during the civil rights movement. And the quote is this, quote, "The existence of violence is at the very heart of a racist system. The Afro-American militant is a militant because he defends himself, his family, his home, and his dignity. He does not introduce violence into a racist social system. The violence is already there and has always been there. It is precisely this unchallenged violence that allows a racist social system to perpetuate itself." And the second quote is from Malcolm X himself, who said, I'm not against using violence in self-defense. I don't call it violence when it's self-defense. I call it intelligence." And I think that's really what we're getting to. We're in a situation of planetary self-defense. As we talked about earlier, you know, we're living through the sixth great mass extinction event. I think people make a mistake when they make any separation between humans and the rest of the planet. You know, I mean, when you poison the world with toxins and chemicals and so on, you poison people. And when you destroy the climate, you destroy the climate that supports us. And when you destroy the oceans, you destroy the source of life from which we emerge.
and, you know, the bounteous source of food and everything that comes from the ocean. I mean, without the oceans, what are we? You know, when I think about these people who want to go to Mars and colonize other planets, you know, they say things like, is there any intelligence out there? You know, and these are the same people who are doing medical experimentation on chimpanzees and monkeys in laboratories. You know, these are the same people who are investing billions of dollars in factories that are destroying the natural world. And, you know, I'm talking about people like Elon Musk here, who some people see as an environmental savior, but who I see as basically a very rich, very intelligent sociopath who is, you know, harnessing the public's fears about global warming in sort of a shock doctrine manner to push through this green technology stuff that really exists to make him a lot of money and not to defend the planet. It destroys the planet just like the coal, oil, and gas does. It just does it in a slightly different way and maybe a lower carbon way. So in terms of, you know, all means necessary, by any means necessary, I think that, you know, the species who are being driven extinct every day, these aren't abstractions. These are our kin, our kindred, our brothers and sisters. And, you know, once you acknowledge the reality that we're not separate from the natural world, then the course becomes pretty clear. You know, what does a mother grizzly bear do when her cub is in danger? She fights. She gets in the way. She defends. She does everything she possibly can. And I think that you know, this system that we're operating in has sort of lulled us into complacency through, you know, nonprofit culture, through these sort of socially acceptable means of protest that we've become so accustomed to. Most people aren't really fighting to win. You know, we've been trained to fight. To fight for its own sake and to fight in these very ineffective ways. And as part of that, you know, I think there's a reason that we all learn the lessons of Dr. King in school, but Malcolm X doesn't get taught, and Stokely Carmichael doesn't get taught, and the Black Panthers don't get taught. You know, and that's not to speak down on Dr. King, because I think there are a lot of lessons there, especially in his more radical turn later in life. But I think we need to go further.
The second part that gets discussed in a lot of your literature about creating self-sustaining communities, I would like your thoughts on how people do these things together. It isn't just a matter of committing to an action and joining a movement or getting focused on a particular issue, that it is changing the way that you view your place in the world.
This culture puts everything in front of my connection with the world. I'm sitting here talking into my laptop, which you know, requires all kinds of rare earth metals to create the electricity and electrical connections that allows my voice to get to you. I'm sitting within a room. It's 15 degrees outside, and yet I'm sitting in a room that is a nice controlled 68 degrees. So at every second of my existence in this culture, I'm separated from the things that give me life. I'm encouraged to think that I'm fine and that I don't need to. There is nothing threatening me. But I think if we're going to start to work together, we're going to have to lose that illusion of our own security. We're going to have to truly feel in our own bones and in our own blood the violence that is being done to our non-human kin, that are being done to people in the colonies. And we're going to have to take those of us with privilege, we're going to have to lose that privilege, and we're going to have to feel the violence that is being done to the world as violence being done to ourselves. And when that happens, we will truly stand in solidarity with each other. And I think we'll start to fight back.
Max.
Yeah, so
Thanks for that, Will. And along those lines, I wrote an article a while back called The Everyday Violence of Modern Culture. And I do think we need to understand that we are living in a war. And, you know, the door that I just opened, the concrete that I'm walking on right now, the cars in the parking lot next to me, all these things are maintained and created by a comprehensive worldwide system of exploitation that constitutes war against the planet. And understanding that we're living in a war really changes how we're going to react to it, because, you know, you don't fight a war by composting, which isn't to say that composting isn't a good thing. I do it myself every day. But you don't win wars by composting. You win wars by fighting. And, you know, in terms of building community, I think we need to build resistance communities. That's one of our goals in DGR. One of my friends likes to say the term radical forgiveness, which I think speaks to me, because so much of the left culture these days is so wrapped up in purity politics, and everyone has to know the exact right term for everything and speak perfectly or else they're going to be excommunicated. When I think if we want to be effective, we need to build a culture of radical forgiveness where we work together, we educate each other. And I guess if I have one final thing to say, it would just be that one of the quotes that really gives me something to hold on to, it was from a guy who was on the National Security Council, believe it or not. Strange reference for me. But what he said was that beforehand, every revolution seems impossible, and afterwards, it seems inevitable. And it sure seems impossible to me right now, or nearly so, but that's not a reason to stop fighting, because we need to win. That's the only option we have.
Max, Wilbert, Will Falk, Deep Green Resistance, thanks for your work. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much for having us. It was a pleasure.
And
absolutely.
Give us contact information again.
Sure, yeah. You can reach Deep Green Resistance at deepgreenresistance.org. The book is free as a PDF on the website, or you can get a paper copy. And, yeah, if you reach out to the contact form on there as well, they could get you in touch with either one of us or other people in your area.
Great. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Visit our website, Your Own Health and Fitness, for easier extended access to our over 700 archive shows with our free library card feature. A free stream of this week's show and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. If you want to reach us, email us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.